Welcome to Rethink, a podcast focused on the future of skilled nursing. I'm Amy Stulick, reporter with Skilled Nursing News. I'm joined for this episode by Kimberly Green, CEO of Sage Integrated Health. Green founded Sage this year, serving the greater Tulsa and Oklahoma City markets. She has been in the skilled nursing industry for decades, formerly as Chief Operating Officer at the Diakonos Group. Green spoke with Skilled Nursing News about her new venture and what it has been like to start a new nursing home business amid ongoing staffing shortages, shifting policy trends, and an industry evolving in real time. Sage is set to close on a continuing care retirement community in September, its first asset, with two more facilities in the pipeline and 10 others being vetted. Before we get to that conversation, I'd like to highlight an upcoming event this summer. Skilled Nursing News 2025 Rethink Conference will take place from August 18th to the 20th in Chicago. Rethink brings executives together for content and networking that addresses trends, challenges, and the future of the nursing home industry, along with M&A outlook, regulatory and reimbursement changes, and staffing opportunities. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to find out more. And now, my conversation with Kimberly Green. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kimberly, for joining us today. The first questions that I have are related to the launch of Sage. So let's talk a little bit more about that. How did this come about and where are you guys at in the process right now?
Well, thank you for your interest. And it's Sage Integrated Health. And this has been quite a journey. So I would say it's a career journey. It's been, you know, over 30 plus years of career getting here as I slowly climbed that ladder to different things. And I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to be an owner, especially post-COVID. You know, there was a lot of scary things happening then. But I worked for the Diakonos Group, as many people know, and I was their chief operating officer for 13 years. And it post-COVID, we opened two super SNFs, and that was a really, really difficult journey. And during that time, my owner had decided that, you know what, he thought he was done. He was just tired and financially drained, and he just, out of nowhere, one day just told me, at least out of nowhere for me, you know, said, I think I want to sell all the SNFs. And we did have a large portfolio of ICF IIDs as well, and he was going to retain those. And so that just put me on the path of thinking, what do I want my next step to be? And so as I interviewed with other companies and had in and outside of the industry, they just never felt right. And so I had to stop, and I'm very spiritual, and pray about it and talk to my team and think about where I really wanted to be. And I kept coming back to I wanted to continue the mission that I have of helping to change the industry and change that narrative. And that was only going to be in an owner seat. And so I started pursuing it that way.
Absolutely. And then I think you touched on this a little bit, but talk a bit more about what motivated you to leave your position at Diakonos and to start your own nursing home business.
Well, you know, after I made the decision that I did want to pursue ownership, I talked to my owner, and it sounded like that the plan going forward would be to buy the SNF side of Diakonos. And that was really exciting. And my team and I worked really hard to make that happen. And so the goal was that I would have between 5 and 9 buildings to start out, which was a great portfolio. You know, it was very exciting. I already knew those buildings. I had my team, and those buildings were running just, you know, within the culture that I had created over 13 years. So that was the best case scenario. And so I went to Nick and met some amazing people, and there was such interest in helping me do that. And can never thank those people. Everybody knows who those are, you know, to help me do that. Unfortunately, whenever whenever it came right down to a couple days before getting the signatures, things just sort of shifted, you know. And then I was left trying to figure out, okay, am I going to continue doing this or not? And luckily, I was already working on a few other buildings at the time, and so I didn't end up getting the Diakonos buildings, and but I am getting other buildings, you know, to add to our portfolio. So it's a smaller portfolio to start with, but it's a very exciting one. And so just had to shift, just as I said earlier. You know, I think in the, as you're moving through this industry, especially on the ownership journey, there's a lot of pivoting. And I just had to pivot. And so here I am, and have some great things coming on board with some great team members that did make the change with me, and a lot of people that are supporting me in the industry.
Wonderful. And could you give us a rundown of how many facilities Sage currently has in its portfolio and locations?
Well, you got me right as I'm coming on board. So those 5 to 9, you know, they sort of took another journey with another owner. And so right now that put me about 6 months behind in what I expected. And so my first building is it's a large CCRC campus. It is scheduled to come on board on 9/1. That's our first one. We're very excited. And then I have two others that I'm working on, and then about 10 others that we're vetting right now.
Exciting times. And so let's take a step back a little bit. You know, I'm kind of curious what advice you have for people who may be considering a similar career move right now in the industry.
Well, you know, the number one piece of advice is to be patient. And to start creating those connections. I was very blessed over the last 13 years that I really have, or actually 30 years, I guess, that I've created a lot of connections. And it's not just something that you leap into quickly. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money. And that doesn't mean, that doesn't mean that you have to have all the money yourself. And I think that that's what scares so many people that were in a similar situation. So as the COO of a company, it's not like I had millions of dollars, you know? And so sometimes the people that are going to come in and change the ownership route are the people that are actually out there doing that, you know, on the ground. And I think that that would make great owners. However, I think that the cost is scary. I think that the timeline can be scary. The unknown can be scary, because it's a totally different world in the ownership group. But don't be afraid to leap. Remember, on the other side, a fear is greatness. And don't be afraid to fail, because that in that failure, you're going to find all those tools to dust yourself off and get up and go again. And understand that within all those connections you've made in your career, there's money to be found to help you get there. And I think that those are probably the biggest pieces of advice, because in this journey, I was knocked down and knocked down and knocked down and told you can't, you can't, you can't. And it was more of, okay, I will learn. Okay, I will find it. Okay, I'm getting back up again, and I'm getting back up again, and I'm getting back up again, over and over and over. And to have those cheerleaders of either your family, your friends, or your colleagues that believe in you, it's just really important to listen to them whenever you're feeling like it's time to give up.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the roadblocks that you encountered while standing up Sage, and maybe what was easier than you expected along the way.
I think let's talk about first what I thought was easier, and then those sort of helped me get back up during the roadblocks. And so what was easier than expected, you know, as the COO, I had created a stellar team, you know, one of the best in the industry, if not the best in the industry, at least to me, and how my leadership works and the culture that we try to create. And they just wanted to go wherever I went. And that was really exciting. It was not any of the questions per se that you'd be fearful of. It was everybody going, "Let's go. I'm right along behind you." And as well as the colleagues in the industry, you know, I sort of expected some kickback and, "Are you sure?" And it was basically everybody just going, "Oh, what can I do to help you?" And that was really, really exciting. It was easier to find the money than I thought. So whenever we went to Nick, you know, my strategy was, I am very transparent and I'm going to sit at that table with all of these people that are used to people having, you know, all these investors and all of these millions of dollars in their bank account. And instead of trying to just act like I knew what I was doing and act like I had all of this money and these investors, when they sat down, I just acknowledged that I knew that we had just a little bit of time. I gave them the rundown of exactly who I am and my perspectives that I bring to the table and the experience I have, which is really vast. It's something I'm really proud of. And that I had hardly any money. You know, it was like, this is the money that I have, and it's all I have because I have been sitting in this seat on the bus for 13 years. And that seat on the bus doesn't bring millions of dollars. But what it does bring is, you know, here's my team and here's the experience I have. And, you know, I had some people just go, "Well, that, you know, we just expect more than that." And I think one of my comments was, "Well, if I brought millions of dollars to the table, you know, that's great. But if I only bring hundreds of thousands, or I only bring 100,000 or whatever it is that someone has to bring, but it's everything I have, isn't that the same? If it's everything my family and I have, isn't that enough skin in the game?" And so some people did walk away, but we had four or five that just, I mean, they reached out before we even left Nick and said, "We believe in you and we think this is fantastic. And it's so great to have people coming to the ownership realm that have lived it and breathed it and still want to do it through all of these, you know, difficulties that we've had, and not just people that think that they want to be owners, you know, that don't have that history." And so there are people out there that want to invest in people like me and people out there that may be listening that want to come into the ownership group. And so don't be fearful of that. That doesn't take away all of the difficulties that I had. And some of those I really don't want to get into the weeds of, but it was just more difficult, I think, for there to be owners that wanted to sell to somebody like me. I found that I would hear that people, you know, that people were selling, and I would reach out and say, "Hey, this is what I want to do." And there were owners, I mean, smaller regional owners or smaller state owners, that you would think, because they were small owners, you know, in a state, that would go, "You know what, I want to sell to someone that's going to keep it local, or I want to sell to someone that's at least small." Or, but I had so many doors shut that would say, "I love you, but I'm not willing to talk to you because you're not going to pay the big money that I can get from some other New York money or East Coast money or large company money that's out there." I heard that over and over and over, and I just didn't understand. I'm like, you know that I am a great provider. You know, I'm clinical by background. You know, I have operations. You know, I have the perspective. You know, I'm on the I'm involved nationally and at state levels. You know, that I lecture all over the country, that I know what I'm doing. I have a great team. And it was just over and over asking for double the money that the buildings would be worth, or, "I'm just not going to let you come.
I'm sorry, I just don't want to waste your time. You know, you don't have the money I'm looking for. And I think that was shocking because what I find, and I just had this discussion with a state provider yesterday, a state association provider in another state. And I said, I feel like that owners like me that have so much to offer to our staff and to the local residents of the state, that I can provide so much. And what I'm being told basically is I can get what everybody else doesn't want. And most of those are ones that, you know, are in dying towns. You know, the census is dying. There's not staff there. And I don't understand that. And so, you know, my goal is to just continue to create all these wonderful relationships that I've had over the years and that networking. And that's how I found this wonderful CCRC that's coming on board that anybody, you know, would love to have. And that's just how I'm going to do it. And it's going to be a much slower process than I thought. You know, I thought everybody knows me and they're going to be so excited, and they are excited. It's just, if it's $60,000 a bed, I can't pay $120,000 a bed. But there's plenty of people that will. And I think that was very hurtful. Yeah, hurt my feelings because people I know, you know, through the years. But it made me feel unsupported from the ownership side. Not to say there's not some owners out there rooting for me, so I don't want it to sound like that. It was just much more difficult and humbling than I expected it to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? We've written about price per bed for M&A. So absolutely makes sense what you've been hearing, but still discouraging, like you said.
Right. And I had hoped already to have a large portfolio because, as you know, it's really hard to have one or two buildings. You know, you don't have the whole support system with all your what people would consider corporate. I call it support, you know, team, because you're small and you have to grow and build again. And it's scary going into everything that, you know, with healthcare, you really need to have a regional presence, as you know, as you well know, in order to sort of survive the next 5 years. So going slowly is a little more difficult for me. It's scary for me and the knowledge that I have of what's coming. And but I just feel it's my mission, and I'm going to continue to push through and really rely on my networking skills and the network I've already built to bring me some great buildings.
Absolutely. And any other thoughts on coming into the nursing home industry as a new provider? Considering the ongoing staffing shortage and uncertain Medicaid future, among other industry trends that we're seeing?
Well, I think one of the things that I had going for me to calm my fears, and anybody that is looking to do that, I really encourage you to reach out to people like me. I mean, I'd love to talk to anybody, you know, about it that may be scared or wanting to try or, you know, their fears. But, you know, having that network of people around the country that are in much larger positions than me, you know, consulting firms and CEOs of large publicly traded companies or REITs and, you know, those kinds of things to call and say, hey, talk me through this. Here's my fear. As a provider, this is my fear. I'm really scared of Medicaid, or, you know, what about the expanding Medicare Advantage? And, you know, what about the new administration? And they'll talk you through all of those things and let you see the perspective, their perspective, which is one that you don't have. You know, like I'm at a 100,000 foot view and they're at a 500,000 foot view. So talk me through that. And then tell me the pitfalls for me as a new owner. You know, what do I need to look for? And so whenever you surround yourself with people like that, it sort of calms the noise in your head, because, you know, I was, of course, the new administration and what about this? And oh, I'm so scared of Medicaid and this is what I see from my perspective. And they were able to give me a bigger perspective so that I could be more strategic in how I was looking at things and developing my plan. And that doesn't take away away the risk for small providers, you know, as you're going, but it does give you a better perspective so that you know what areas to avoid and what areas that you probably didn't think about in order to make you more successful.
Okay. And a couple of topical questions for you next. Are there any policy changes, this can be existing or up and coming, that you have your eye on currently?
Of course, you know, we're all watching Washington very closely. And also state. I mean, I don't know if you are, if you know Oklahoma very well, but Oklahoma is, I think, 48th in the country on Medicaid, you know, so it's a very regulatory complex state, and so it can be very scary. So I think that the enhanced civil monetary penalties that are effective in 2025, I think that those could help us better calibrate how we're calculating those CMPs. And so that way that maybe we won't get, especially, I mean, like an Oklahoma CMP for an IJ is just huge. And so hopefully that they will be able to look at the harm or the likelihood of harm, and instead of just having one big penalty, hopefully we're able to adjust those. So that could significantly impact our compliance costs. So that could be good, that could be bad. So I'm sure trying to hope for the best on that. I think especially in Oklahoma, I think that our legislators are listening more, and the state's really wanting some collaborative engagement now, instead of it just seeing like it's just penalties for us. And so I'm really excited about that. And then, of course, the survey process changes that CMS is set to implement. And the critical element pathways for surveyors is exciting. Risk-based surveys, I am a little excited about that, but that timeline's unclear. You know, those shorter, more focused surveys, oh my gosh, that would be fantastic. You know, some of our facilities have had surveys as long as 9 days, you know, with as many as 10 surveyors. You know, so having a shorter, more focused, and hopefully less surveyors in the building so that the buildings can operate more efficiently and effectively while they're actually in the building doing the survey process, and for our team to understand the process better, because there's some actual guidelines on it as far as focused and shorter, would be wonderful. As far as Washington, I'm not really too concerned about the changes there. And I know we have some other questions that you may ask about that. But I think that as we've heard from American Healthcare, the focus really hasn't been on the nursing home industry. I think that everyone is really concerned about the Medicaid. But as I look through it, none of us have read it in its entirety, of course. It's just impossible to read in its entirety. So we're really relying on, you know, consulting firms and consultants, you know, to help walk us through some of that and some of our lobbyists. But I'm not too concerned about that. And I hope that I stay not too concerned as it goes through. But the removal of the staffing mandate, of course, we're all kissing the ground for that. And hope that stays, you know, at bay. So I think that even though that's a long-winded answer for you, hopefully that answers state and national.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm glad that you mentioned the Medicaid cuts in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, because from what I understand, it's more affecting home and community-based services rather than nursing homes. Is that kind of what you understood as well?
Yes, but you know, there is a side of that that I think some providers may not be thinking about, and that's that it will, that big beautiful bill is going to hit hospitals severely. And I know their lobbyist groups, you know, that are really working hard, so hopefully they get some solutions for that. But what we need to worry about as providers, there are those large cuts for the hospitals. The hospitals will have to find money, right? And so some of that will be that hospitals may open swing beds again, at least in the more rural areas, and they will start trying to skill as many people as they can. So those people that those rural providers have been relying on, you know, to stay open, their skilled population would decrease. And so that could impact us. So even though the big beautiful bill in, you know, would not take our Medicaid, it could take our Medicare in a different kind of way. You know, the bill itself wouldn't strip the money. It would be the hospitals trying to find the money and taking those people that we would be skilling. And so I am concerned, you know, about that. And so getting those relationships with the hospitals, finding different paths to revenue, you know, in those rural areas, I think is going to be really, really important. And I'm hoping all of these rural providers have thought of that and are planning for that. If not, I hope they're listening and they're thinking through that as well, because those hospitals will have to find money. And utilizing our skilled patients would be a quick way to make some money for them.
Mm-hmm. So let's shift to value-based care for a bit. I'm curious your thoughts on the future of value-based care with the current administration. There seems to be some mixed messaging when it comes to Medicare Advantage in particular.
You know, I don't necessarily think that it's mixed or contradictory. I think it's more like a philosophical shift, maybe. They're wanting to shift. It's deliberate, you know, shifting from that public sector value-based care to private sector value-based care. So they're wanting it to go from a government-led to market-led approaches. But they still want that the controlled cost and the quality. And so they're expanding that Medicare Advantage, that private insurance-driven value-based care, and they're cutting that the government-driven value-based care. So I think that the industry in general has a little bit of confusion. I think like the large providers and everything get it. I'm not sure that the smaller providers have that message yet. That it's more of an industry confusion on, you know, the providers who are participating in that government value-based model, like an ACO REACH or whatever, and they're now being told to work with Medicare Advantage plans instead. And I think that they're thinking, oh, they're so similar, you know, this is really confusing. But it's more of, we have to look at it as the Medicare Advantage is not going away. It is, they want that private market-led approach. They just don't want the government to do it anymore. And so I think that if they think of it like that and then go after the Medicare Advantage plans to negotiate contracts, and remember that they can be negotiated. I know smaller providers, you know, have a lot of difficulty doing that, but it's really all in those relationships and networks, and being completely educated. Because these models are value-based and very different from the collaborative government models. And so I think people just need to realize this is a philosophical shift, and not really contradictory.
Mm-hmm. And then how else do you think that the current administration will shape the nursing home industry?
You know, I don't know. I don't think they know enough about it, you know, to, I think they know enough that they don't necessarily want to hurt it so far. I mean, that's what I'm getting so far. But I'm relying on the current administration's willingness to listen to experts such as American Healthcare, you know, and then all of the people that pour into American Healthcare so that that messaging is what we need. So I just don't think that they understand us. But I think they're willing to listen. I really don't have too much to say other than that, because I'm very guarded on what's to come, as I've said before. But I think that with them taking away that staffing mandate for us, at least for now, shows that they're really wanting to listen and that they understand that there's a lot of difficulties for us. So I'm really hopeful on American Healthcare and our lobbyists helping to create and mold something special for us in the coming years of the administration.
Mm-hmm. And then, are there any federal or state programs that you're excited to pursue as a new provider? This could be reimbursement incentives, staffing initiatives, or maybe other pilot programs stateside as well.
There are, for rural providers, there are, I'm trying to remember the names of them, but it's helpful for the CMS Nursing Home Staffing Campaign for the RN incentive. I am excited about that. You know, CMS, it, you know, hopefully will roll out that money for Nursing Home Staffing Campaign. And Trump administration said they're keeping it. So the RNs can start applying for those financial incentives. So hopefully that will help us get more RNs. And you know, we need more RNs, even though they're, you know, so expensive, we need them. And RNs are not choosing us to come into. And I often say the reason, you know, nursing and physicians, you know, geriatricians are not coming into our industries because they're not exposed to it in school. And so if we have CMS, you know, doing these financial incentives for staff, it will make people look at us that may not have looked at us before. So I am excited about that one. And then for rural, the HRSA Health Workforce Grant, the Nurse Corps Scholarship Program. And it's only for specific areas that really have difficulty, you know, recruiting staff. But they pay tuition fees and other educational costs with a monthly stipend. And so I am excited about the possibility for that to help us. I'm excited for the CMP grant programs, and I'm hopeful, crossing my fingers and my toes, that that will be positive for the state of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. And then to wrap us up, Kimberly, I have a couple of future-looking questions for you. I'm curious what established operators can learn from new providers in the nursing home sector.
Oh, I love new providers. I think that, you know, it's just like I love to hire new staff, you know, people that just came out of school, you know, and the reason for that is they have new ideas. And I think it's really easy as an older provider to get stuck in how we've always done things, or get stuck in just how large providers do things. And it's always exciting to what I always tell my teams, I always say to dream without boundaries. And new providers do that. Because what I say is, if you dream within the boundary of reimbursement and regulations and staffing, and you put yourself in that box, and then you say, well, dream, well, you're never going to come up with anything new, ever. And so, but if you dream without boundaries and you just put it all on the table and you start saying, well, I can do 1% of this and 2% of this, and I can't do that one, but I can do this one, then you start coming up with new things. And so I think that older providers or larger providers can learn a lot from the excitement and passion that new providers are bringing to the table because they just have different ideas.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you expect the sector to further evolve in the coming years? Like, what factors will influence its evolution?
I don't think that the sector as it exists today will exist within 10 years, even possibly 5 years, because, you know, I mean, as you know, I mean, everybody says it, it's the largest geriatric population in the history of mankind, you know, and it's, they're all getting to the age where they need us and they have different expectations. And then of course, with everything that happened through COVID, the government has different expectations as well. And so I think what we will be looking at is, of course, a lot of policy and regulatory shifts, which are going to make us have to become more innovative in how we're delivering care. Our labor costs are continuing to rise faster than reimbursement rates. And with that, we also have, which is a new provider. I just had to turn down a deal the other day that's really exciting to build a new super SNF. I've done that. I'm known for that. And as a small provider myself, instead of having an ownership, you know, group behind me, those real estate and construction costs make building these new buildings extremely challenging. So the concern with that is most of the facilities in the country are to the age that they are not going to be functional much longer. So I think that the government will have to give some incentives for us to build new buildings. But with building those new buildings, I think we will have to build totally different types of buildings. I don't think that the public wants to go into an institutional setting anymore. And I think that these small home environments are absolutely what is going to, our industry will evolve in, but I think it will be different than it's being done now. I think we will have long-term care small homes, and then we are going to have health and wellness homes. That is where the people that are doing the rehab, the skilled, and being able to go to less restrictive environments such as assisted living or residential care, those kinds of things, that those will be separate. And that's just my perspective, you know, being in the industry for so long. I think that that is what this, who we're going to be serving in the next 5 to 15, 20 years, that's what they want. You know, they don't want to go into the traditional facilities. It's just where are we going to get the money? You know, families are demanding private rooms. They want the hotel-like amenities. They want to be heavily involved. They want different types of food and different types of activities, you know, but at the same time, you know, they also want that transparency requirement that we're seeing, you know, where there's ownership disclosure and things like that. And as owners, it is so much more difficult to keep your reputation going great because social media and online reviews, you know, so people that love that love you don't often leave the reviews, but people that are upset, you know, leave horrible reviews. And so the whole industry has to take a more public-facing stance, but with those economic pressures and consumer expectations at the forefront. And of course, as you know, we're going to have AI, you know, and AI is going to become a huge part of our industry. And so I think the people that will thrive are the high quality operators. I think that, like me, you're going to have to build a portfolio to be more of a regional operator and less of a mom and pop. You're going to have to scale so that you have the support. And anybody that is dependent on regulatory arbitrage, they're low quality operators. I mean, they're going to struggle. And facilities that just say, I just want to do it the way we've always done it because it works for me. I think that those people that are resistant will really struggle. So it's going to look dramatically different. It's going to be more specialized, more integrated, more tech-enabled. And I think that we have to be more responsible to those consumer preferences.
And then lastly, this is the Rethink podcast. So what do you think people should rethink about nursing homes? This could be from the public's perspective, operators, government officials.
You know, this is sort of a soapbox of mine. And as I've, been looking at all the industry publications just recently, I've seen there are more people saying this publicly. And so that really excites me because I feel like I've been alone for years and people just rolling their eyes at me. But the way to change our industry, I think people need to rethink the public. We have to have a huge movement of changing the public's perception. And that does include other industries such as the hospital industry, physicians, and things like that in there. But the public's perception of our industry is so negative, and it's driven by the latest attorney's commercial, that's on TV, because the public doesn't go into nursing homes anymore until they need them. So they're not going in to volunteer and doing the things like they did whenever I was coming up, when I was little and as a teenager. And so they have no perspective. And so their perception is very poor. And with that perspective comes, we don't have people fighting for us. And so if we change the public's perspective to a more positive, supportive perspective, then we would also have the money that follows. They would support the anything that we're trying to get done legislatively. They would fight for us. So I often compare it to, so in Oklahoma, we had a teacher strike 1 year. And the teachers went on strike and walked out, and within hours, the public was all over the legislators and fighting and writing letters and on the news and fought for them so that they got so many things that they wanted and were able to return to the classroom. If we can't exactly strike and walk out, but any time that there is something that we're fighting for, we're begging. We are begging people. And what happens is when you put it on social media, you get the hundreds of people that have the perception that we're all bad. And so if we would focus as an industry on a very large push to change public perspective, we would have staff getting interested, physicians getting interested in coming to work in this industry. We would have people that are going to fight for us to get the money. And it would change, it would help us go into the next 5 to 10 years. We would have the money to do and the things that we want to do. We would have the public support to do the things we want to do. And we would be seen as a step in the healthcare system and not the end for people. And that's how they see us. They see it as the very bottom of the barrel end for people. And that's not what we are. And, they could see us as part of the aging process and how we can help support that aging process and that aging continuum. And that we're not the stop. Sometimes we are getting you back home. Often we're getting you back home, and we wouldn't be fighting the staffing and all of those things as well. So I think that's the answer for us. And I'm excited to see other people starting to see that. But that is how we need to rethink. We need to rethink how we are putting ourselves out there to the public. And it needs to be a big push for our industry.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kimberly, for a great conversation. And definitely excited to see Sage grow. And we'll be keeping an eye out for you guys.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about Sage.
That does it for this episode of Rethink. I'd like to remind listeners about our upcoming Rethink conference from August 18th to the 20th in Chicago. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to learn more and get tickets. Until next time, thanks for listening.